It's always a pleasure to be here at Perimeter Institute. So what I'm going to talk about today is actually the paper which appeared on Archive yesterday. Okay, so it's pretty fresh, though it's based on a number of works which I was doing some time ago together with Andrej Shkirin, and we have some kind of new thing, as we believe, which we've done together with Sebastian Zell, who started as a postdoc in my group last October. Okay, so I'm going to start from introduction and motivation, and I will describe my view on naturalness. Then I will talk about a semi-classical relation between Fermi and Planck scale. And then we will see that in a certain setup, one can find one can explain why the weak scale, the Fermi scale, is much smaller than the Planck scale, and that there might exist the semi-classical relation between these two scales. And then I will tell you that exactly the same theory which leads to this semi-classical relation between Fermi and Planck scale is actually very good from another point of view, the point of view of inflation. And then I come back to conclusions. Okay, so everybody knows that since already quite a number of years, the standard model is now complete. The last particle, the Higgs boson, which was predicted by this theory, has been found. Moreover, and that will be very important for my talk, is that no significant deviations from the standard model were observed. Yet another point, which is also very essential for me, is that with experimental values of masses of the top quark and of the Higgs boson, the standard model is a self-consistent effective field theory all the way up to the quantum gravity scale and Planck.
When you say standard model, what about neutrino masses? Do you regard them as part of the scale?
I'll come to that. Let me talk about just the standard model as it was invented by Weinberg, Salam, and Gleschow without neutrino masses, though I will make some comment about that as well later on.
What you mean is there are no Landau poles or something before?
Yeah, there are no Landau poles. There is nothing. So it's a weakly coupled theory up to the Planck scale. It could have been another way around. So for instance, if the Higgs at LHC would be discovered with the mass greater than 180 GeV or so, we would get Landau pole before the Planck scale. Or if the Higgs would be lighter than 110 GeV or so, then the vacuum, electroweak vacuum, would be unstable with a lifetime smaller than the universe age. And this also inconsistency. But it didn't happen this way. And the Higgs mass is well inside this window between Landau pole and fast instability. People sometimes underline that with the values of the Higgs mass and the top mass, which was found today, our vacuum is metastable, and it lives a long time. The evidence for this point is actually less than 2 sigma, because there are uncertainties in the measurement of top quark Yukawa coupling. So what experimentalists measure at the LHC, they measure what is called the Monte Carlo top mass. And there is a non-trivial connection, which is not known with necessary accuracy between these two numbers. OK, so in spite of all these successes, the standard model was condemned to be unnatural. But let's see what the naturalness means. So actually, naturalness is a rather technical criterion, which can be formulated as follows. So that the physics at electroweak scale or above it should be organized in such a way that quadratic divergences in the Higgs boson mass are eliminated to remove sensitivity of the Higgs mass to physics at a very large energy scale, such as the scale of grand unification. And if you take a theory in which this doesn't happen, then the theory is called unnatural and fine-tuned. And in the diagrams, you say it in this way. You take the Higgs mass, you take the top quark loop for the Higgs mass. So this diagram is, by naive count, power counting, is divergent quadratically. Then you add new physics in such a way that this quadratic divergency is eliminated. And if you play this game, then you are forced to say that this new physics should lie close to electroweak scale. Sorry?
You go. I can play a little bit with that because I mean, there's many things that are called naturalists, but technical naturalists, which you don't quite call it, but it's, I would say technical naturalists is not this criterion, because this criterion is tracking the dependence on the cutoff, and the thing is the cutoff is the one thing you know is not in any physical answer, so why do you care if it's quadratic divergent? I would say that technical naturalist is a statement that if you embed the standard model into something with a physical mass threshold that's large, do you get any contributions to low energy small things that are proportional to the physical mass, you know, the normalized masses, mm-hmm. which is a different criterion, right? And
but they're related to each other, and I'm actually coming to this point.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, my question is, this is a criterion for perturbative.
Yes.
Methods.
Yes.
If you're working in non-perturbative setup to an approach to the quantum scale, then you don't. That this criterion of naturalness, how would it look?
This is not my criterion, okay? And I'm actually struggling with it. So I'm telling you what what other people call naturalness.
But I would say that in principle, the statement would be the same. It's just the hard part would be calculating the dependence on the mass. But if you're flowing down from high energies and the value you find at low energies is requires cancellations between different orders,
okay, so as was correctly pointed out here, this issue about quadratic divergences is somewhat unphysical because quadratic divergence is something technical. So in fact, if I can remind you the history, the whole problem about naturalness of hierarchy problem appeared quite a long time ago, and I would attribute it to 1976. So what happened at that time, and a little bit before that time, is that grand unified theories for weak, strong, and electromagnetic interactions were invented. And in these theories, the new particle physics scale appeared for the first time, which was much, much larger than the observed scale, such as mass of the proton, mass of the W boson. So this was scale associated with very heavy particles, leptoquarks, which existed in grand unified theories. And the mass of these particles was 10 to the 15 GeV. And this number was coming from many different considerations. It was coming from the gauge coupling unification, the couplings of strong, weak, and electromagnetic interactions evolve and meet at some particular point, which is about 10 to the 15 GeV. But this very large scale in grand unified theories was also required from phenomenological considerations. These particles, leptoquarks, they were responsible for the proton decay. We know that the proton lives a long time, and from here, you can get a lower bound on this mass. Okay, so at that time, for the first time in physics, we met an indication that some very, very heavy particles may exist. And that leads to the following problem, which was exactly discussed in this paper by Gildener. So he said, OK, fine. It's indeed very strange that we have a weak scale, which is 100 GeV. And then grand unified scale, which is 10 to the 15 GeV, and these two scales are physical. Suppose that we organize our theory in such a way that these two scales appear in tree approximation. And let's try to see what happens if we compute radiative corrections. And if you compute radiative corrections, we will find out that this very large scale propagates down. So these loops in which we have very heavy particles will spoil the smallness of the Higgs mass or smallness of the Fermi scale in comparison with Grand Unified scale. And if you want to make this fine tuning, you have to make sure that in 14th order of order by order, 14 loop, we have to adjust the parameters in such a way that this heavy scale doesn't spoil the smallness of the Fermi scale. Okay, so and this is associated with quadratic divergences because this new mass which appears there in this type of loops appears not through logarithms, but it appears like this. Okay, so everything is proportional to this mass, and if I look at the previous transparency with the quadratic divergences, then these two things are certainly related to each other. Okay, of course we can say, well,
could you just say alpha guide is a small
alpha? No, alpha. We know what alpha is. Alpha is the Grand Unified coupling, which is 1 divided by 30. So this is so we know this gauge coupling. Well, of course, you can say that, okay, it's a nightmare for a theorist to compute 7 loops. But for God, who designed all that, it's a piece of cake. And if he managed to do that in a tree approximation, the loops do not count. But still, there is some uneasy feeling about this problem. Okay, so there were quite a number of solutions proposed to cure this naturalness issue. And here is the list of most popular solutions. So one of them is associated with low energy supersymmetry. So if you have low energy supersymmetry, then you have loops with bosons, you have loops as fermions, the bosons compensate fermions, and if the scale of supersymmetry breaking is sufficiently small of the order of the Wick scale, then this compensation is very good, and all these diagrams do not contribute. And so you tune this number in tree approximation, and then it's automatic in all orders. Yet another approach to that was associated with the composite Higgs boson, technicolor. Yet another approach was associated with large extra dimensions, where you assume that the fundamental Planck scale is actually not that large, so the order of Wick scale. And since extra dimensions are kind of large, at the end of the day, you get very large Planck scale in the four-dimensional worlds. Well, in any event, all these proposed solutions require a new physics right above the Fermi scale, which was expected to show up at the LHC, but it didn't. And this leads me to conclusion that perhaps we should rethink the question of naturalness and perhaps the change the paradigm.
Another possibility is that the quantum field theory isn't right.
Yeah, sure.
Because you're doing renormalization theory.
Yes, I would share this point of view. But then this is even more drastic step.
Maybe
not. It's a matter
of
opinion. Yeah.
Cosmology question. Is this the sort of thing that we are doing all the time with modified gravity when we higher order derivatives of the scalar field? I mean, it's associated with quadratic divergences, right? So are we all incurring in a lot of trouble?
Oh, say it again.
So in modified gravity for cosmology, mm-hmm. we add higher order derivatives frequently. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that it's the same kind of, is that where you're going?
I'm not going to modify gravity.
Okay. That's good.
Okay, so what I was arguing before is that the physical source of this hierarchy problem was the presence of heavy particles, such as leptic quarks. Okay, and why not to try the following hypothesis? Heavy particles are dangerous. The fact that the Higgs mass is so much smaller than the Planck scale, or Fermi scale is so much smaller than the Planck scale, perhaps just telling us that there are no heavy particles whatsoever. Okay, there are just light particles in the theory or in nature. And if this is the case, there is no large physics scale associated with particle physics. And therefore, you may have no tuning. Yeah, this is a pretty strong statement, because if this is indeed the case, then all new physics which we are allowed to have are new particles which are light, which have masses smaller than the weak scale, which are, when they appear in the loops, they do not change the Higgs mass.
Can I ask, is it fair to say that this assumption also requires that whatever the UV completion of gravity is doesn't have any massive states in it, like massive string states or something, or massive excitations of gravitons? Like, none of that would be allowed, right?
Well, that depends whether the states are, well, it's difficult to say, because in order to really answer this type of question, we should be able to solve quantum gravity and understand very well what is happening there.
Of course. I mean, without a theory, we can't say anything for sure. But if the Higgs is a scalar, it's, you know, like, it sort of couples to everything. The H squared operator can't be forbidden from coupling to anything by symmetries. So if gravity has any massive excitations, then it would not fall in this rubric, because like, just from symmetry arguments, we would expect those massive states.
Yeah, that depends what kind of states we have in mind, whether the states are fundamental or composite. So let me give you an example. Okay. So for instance, we can take an SU2 theory, which contains monopoles. Okay, monopoles are the states which have large mass, and this mass is inversely proportional to the gauge coupling constant. These states are absolutely not dangerous from this point of view. Yeah, they're very soft, because they, if you want, they have too large entropy, or they're composite from two other states, and their coupling to other particles is extremely small. So the same thing may happen with gravity. So for instance, Giyad Vali, who is a proponent of classicalization and self-completion of gravity, so in his picture, you do have heavy states in gravity, which are black holes. Now, if the black hole of a minimal size is sufficiently massive, it has entropy, and it will be coupled only weakly to the Higgs boson. And so its contribution to the loops, again, will be suppressed. OK.
But anything like string theory wouldn't work?
Most probably not.
Yeah.
Okay.
OK. You said a little bit more aggressively, right, in the sense that there's lots of proposals for ultraviolet physics, like Gia's and things, that are not quite formulated crisply enough that you can ask the question.
Right.
But even if you don't believe string theory is true, string theory is an example of a UV, probably the only example, I don't know anyway, that where a UV completion is proposed for which you can ask the question concretely. And then I think it's fair to say that there's no known example in string theory which has this property, right? They all have string states, and they all have
I think that's
okay. So maybe that's an argument against string theory,
yes,
right?
It could be. Yeah, I think
you still have to explain, you still have a cutoff.
Mm-hmm.
You have to explain why it's not like mass.
No, yeah, I'm coming to that. Yeah, of course, in our theory, we have another physical parameter, which is M Planck. Okay? But M Planck is not a mass of any particle. It's a strength of interaction.
But what is the cutoff? It's there, okay?
Yeah, I'll come into that. Okay.
How much lower than M Planck? According to your argument, Planck already is too much problem. It had to be much below Gata scale.
Say it again.
You're saying it has to be much smaller than the Planck, and MP is not a mass of any particle, but it was even much lower than Gata scale. And
it's like an electroweaker scale.
It has to be like no particle above electroweaker.
Yes, yes, that's right.
Misha has to get on with his talk.
Yes. Okay, so coming to that, all new physics below the Planck scale, right? We do need new physics because we have neutrino masses, as it was mentioned here. We have to explain baryon asymmetry of the universe. We have to explain what is dark matter. Okay, there is no problem whatsoever to do that with new particles which have masses below the Fermi scale. And the simplest example here is the theory which we called new MSM, neutrino minimal standard model, which is the standard model plus three right-handed neutrinos. And if you take this theory, then with new particles with masses of the order of 1 GeV keV, you can explain everything. You can explain neutrino masses, you can explain dark matter, you can explain barogenesis. So there is no problem from this point of view. And phenomenologically, this type of conjecture is very well, can very well be true. Okay, so now I'm coming to the question. Yes, indeed, if you don't have any heavy particles between the Fermi scale and the Planck scale, we still have the Planck scale, okay? This can be considered as a cutoff. This can be considered as a constant which determines the gravitational interactions. Note that the mass of the particle which is associated with gravity, the mass of the graviton is equal to zero. So this is a light particle. So, but there is an absolutely legitimate, and for me, it's the most interesting question, why the weak scale is so much smaller than the Planck scale. And now let me take just some analogy which we know from quantum mechanics, which we know from different branches of quantum physics. There is a place where very, very small numbers appear in quantum physics, and they appear absolutely naturally. And these numbers are associated with quantum tunneling. So, and here are two famous examples. One is theory of alpha decay, the decay rate when you emit alpha particles from a nuclear is very, very small, which is associated with tunneling. And this width is naturally exponentially suppressed in comparison with the basic energy, few MeV. And yet another example is the tunneling in the double well potential, which is a trivial exercise in quantum mechanics, but which lead to, say, discovery of ammonia laser. So could it be that the weak scale is a fraction of the Planck scale times some tunneling exponent? And what I'm going to argue that this might be the case. Okay, so just numerics first. This ratio, MH over M Planck, is about 10 to the minus 16. And so if there is some mechanism which would lead to the exponential suppression, then this number S should be of the order of 36. Okay, so the conjecture which I'm going to present here is the following. Suppose that there is only one fundamental scale in nature, M Planck, and the electroweak scale is generated from it in non-perturbative way. Okay, non-perturbative, it would be mean for me semi-classically. And therefore, I will be searching for the effects which could lead to a large exponential suppression of the Planck scale. So what kind of requirements to the basic theory we should impose? So first of all, in perturbation theory, we should get mass of the Higgs equal to zero, exactly. Because if that is not the case, we will get perturbative contributions to the mass of the Higgs, and perturbative contribution will destroy this picture. And then, of course, we would need some semi-classical configurations, which would need a non-zero value of the Higgs wave in such a way that this Higgs wave is much smaller than in Planck. So let's first consider the first criterion. So we should have a theory in which the Higgs mass is equal to zero. Okay. So if we should find out first the symmetry which could lead to zero Higgs mass. And this symmetry is well known. This is conformal symmetry. So if you take the classical Lagrangian of the standard model and put in it mass of the Higgs boson to zero, then you will discover that this Lagrangian is not just invariant with respect to the standard model group, Poincaré group, but it's valid that it's invariant with respect to much larger group, which is a conformal group. Okay. Yes?
The beginning of the standard lecture 8 bar is you put all the masses to zero, including the fermions, in order to get renormalizability. And then you do spontaneous symmetry breaking, because you suddenly think, my goodness, I've lost all my masses. Continues to get the masses. So you still need all these masses to be zero to have conformal symmetry.
Yes, yes. But this exactly happens because in the standard model, all masses are coming from the Higgs wave. And if you put Higgs mass to zero, then wave of the Higgs field is equal to zero, and then all masses disappear. And then you do have a conformal symmetry here.
That depends on whether that's the correct statement. All the masses come from.
Sure.
There's no absolute calculation of masses. It's all put in ad hoc.
Yes, but in the standard model, this is associated with ad hoc choice of Yukawa couplings. So yeah.
Sorry, are you talking about global? You have also a special conformal transformation that just.
Yeah, everything.
Okay.
Yeah, so the standard, this is.
This is broken by gauge interaction.
Right. No.
Like the running of the gauge coupling.
Yeah, I'm coming to that.
Okay. But
this is quantum.
Yeah.
I was talking about classical.
Yeah.
I don't want classical. So the statement is, take the classical electroweak theory, put the Higgs mass to zero, then it is invariant with respect to 15 parameter conformal group, which includes dilatations and special conformal transformation.
Period. You have to break conformal symmetry.
Yes, I'm coming to that. That's exactly the topic of my talk. Okay, so and the fact that we get this enhanced symmetry, the people tried to explore to understand the smallness of the Higgs mass, and so Bardeen was doing that. Okay. There are many attractive features of classical scale invariant conformal theories. There are no explicit mass parameters, only dimensionless couplings. What would be most interesting for me is that if we include now quantum corrections to this theory, then the Higgs mass can be predicted. Okay. To be more precise, the Higgs mass can be expressed through the vector boson mass. Okay, so this is a very well known statement, which comes from the famous paper of Coleman and Weinberg, written back in 1972. So here is an abstract for this paper, and here is the ratio between the Higgs mass and the vector mass which they found. So this ratio is some numerical factor times the electric charge square. So let me remind you how this happens and what this paper was about. So they took abelian Higgs model with a sufficiently small scalar self-coupling, lambda of the order of g to the fourth, and the scalar mass equal to zero. In this theory, the scale invariance and conformal invariance, classical scale invariance, are broken due to radiative correction, as was pointed out by you. In fact, what happens in the theory, though you started from dimensionless parameter, dimensional full parameters appear as a dimensional transmutation. There is renormalization group running of all parameters. All physical quantities depend on the scale logarithmically. And the reason why you can predict the scalar mass here is actually very simple. Take any scale independent regularization such as DIMREG. And then in this regularization, all the county terms are polynomial in coupling constants and parameters such as the mass. And so if you put the only dimensional full parameter in this theory to zero, then you see that no county term is needed to renormalize the Higgs mass. And if there is no infinity, there is something which you can predict. On some another language, if you look at RG equation for this parameter, then it has a fixed point when mass of the Higgs boson is put to zero. Yes?
Just to orient a bit, are you now saying that the Higgs mass has been obtained by a symmetry breaking, or are we not yet there?
This is next page.
Okay.
So you are ahead of me.
Also just say if it's second order or first order?
Yeah. Okay.
Common doesn't work. It's too small.
Sure. I'm coming to that. Yeah you are always ahead of me. It's on the next page. Okay. So I would like to stress that in this theory, any power-like divergence contribution to the Higgs boson mass are purely technical because there is no any physics scale. And what Coleman and Weinberg done in original paper, they use this type of, they didn't use DIMREG, they use cutoff regularization, but they put this type of normalization condition. So this normalization condition is specifically used to say that the Higgs mass is absent in the tree approximation. So what you do, you compute Coleman-Weinberg effective potential. You find out that the phi field is actually non-zero. The symmetry is broken. And then you read off the ratio between the Higgs boson mass and the vector boson masses. Okay, period. So that's a great theory. That's a great suggestion. And of course, people try to apply it to the standard model. Okay, so here is the list of people who did that, Linde, Weinberg, okay, many, many people. And it doesn't work. Okay. In the old days, in the 60s, in 70s, when the Higgs mass was not known, there was a prediction for the Higgs mass coming from this consideration. Well, at that time, the mass of the top was not known. And the prediction was that the Higgs mass should be equal to 5 something GeV. Okay. Then when the time went, the people found that the top mass is very large, 175 GeV. And now you try to play with this mechanism for the top mass so large, you found out that it doesn't work. Period. Okay. If the top mass is smaller than some critical value, which is about 170 GeV, pretty much close to what we observe, then you find that the minimum of the effective potential is generated at very small scales of the order of QCD scale due to chiral symmetry breaking in QCD, which gives you a prediction which is completely wrong. And if the top quark mass is larger than this value, then you find out that this effective potential generates the vacuum expectation value, which is of the order of Planck scale, which is again many orders of magnitude larger than we observe. So the conjecture on idea fails, and but still mechanism is so attractive that people try to change the standard model, add to the model different ingredients to make the idea work. So for instance, you can add extra gauge bosons and you can find a theory which works, or you can add extra fermions, extra scalars, et cetera, et cetera. However, I would say that this, of course, very interesting, but in the theory, we do have the strong breaking of conformal symmetry. We do have a breaking of scale symmetry because of gravity. Okay, so we have gravity, we add gravity, gravity comes with a very large Planck scale, and therefore, the first thing which we should do is to study whether the gravity itself can or cannot introduce the breaking of the electroweak symmetry. Okay, so if you take again scale invariant regularization such as Dirac, we will find out that gravity doesn't contribute. Okay, why so? Because M Planck, again, it's not a mass of any particle. It's the coupling constant. And any counter term which you need to introduce to gravity, okay, there are infinite number of them because gravity is not a normalizable theory, they will be all suppressed by the Planck scale. Okay, and so there is a rationale in saying that gravity can be neglected. Okay, and yes, perturbatively, gravity can be neglected. Still, if we have the standard model, which is conformal invariant plus gravity, the RG equation remain in force. So MH equal to square is a fixed point. But the question arises that, okay, this is all perturbative argument. Perhaps there are non-perturbative effects which break down this completely, and maybe due to this non-perturbative effects, the fixed mass can be generated. Okay. But what is important is that it will be predictable in spite of the fact that we have and that the gravity is not renormalizable. Okay, so I would say that if we have conformal invariant standard model plus gravity, then we get a theory which is an idle playground in which we can look for a non-perturbative generation of the Fermi scale. Okay, and here is the model. It happened to be extremely simple. Actually, Andrei Shkerin and myself were looking at this problem already a couple of years ago, and we were struggling in finding out the simple theory which can accommodate this idea, but now we have this model at hand, and it happened to be just Palatini. It is associated with Palatini formulation of gravity with non-minimal coupling. Okay, so as simple as that. So let me remind you what Palatini formulation of gravity is, just in two words.
Phi is the Higgs, or phi is another field.
Yeah, yeah. So phi is the Higgs. Phi will be the Higgs. So we have, of course, metric formulation of gravity in which the degree of freedom is G mu, and that's the only degree of freedom. In Palatini formulation, we have two independent gravitational variables. One is the metric, and another is Levi-Civita connection, and they are considered to be independent from very beginning. And then the relation between Levi-Civita connection and metric appears due to equations of motion. Okay, these two formulations happen to be absolutely equivalent if you don't have non-minimal coupling. Okay, Einstein gravity and Pauliniano gravity are exactly the same. However, they are different if non-minimal coupling are introduced. Why they are different? Because when you write down the equation for Levi-Civita connection, this equation will get an extra terms which are proportional to the derivatives of the scalar field. Yes?
How much does this depend on B being lambda phi to the fourth?
Sorry?
There's no experimental evidence from some that this is true.
Yes, there is no, not yet. Yeah, yeah.
Theory is not renormalizable now because of gravity. So you don't have to worry about that. Because lambda phi to the fourth is renormalizable.
Yes.
Lambda phi to the sixth is not.
Yes.
But since your theory is not renormalizable, you can throw that away. It's not renormalizable.
I can throw away what? This term or the whole theory? Sorry?
Another way of saying the same question would be, because gravity is not renormalizable, if I really wanted to calculate some observable with energies at the Planck scale or something, I would have a whole bunch of counterterms I'd have to include. Yeah.
So,
and when you write that Lagrangian down, you're setting all those counterterms to zero, essentially at the renormalized level at some scale. That's the assumption.
It is not an assumption because I will see that, yes, I will have to add a few terms and they will be important in this consideration. So this is just the theory to start with.
So you could have lambda phi to the eighth.
Yes. I could have added lambda phi to the eighth. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But it's not going to spoil anything, this type of terms. That's what I'm going to argue. So this is just the theory to start with. And let me tell you what the mechanism which we have in mind is about. And then we will see what kind of.
One question. Are you able from this Pallottini formulation with the non-minimal coupling, are you able to transport that into the Einstein frame?
Yeah, yeah. Sure, sure. Next slide. Yeah, we'll see. Yes, you can. Of course, I mean, all formulations, you can always find a Lagrangian in Einstein frame, which would correspond to this particular Lagrangian in the metric formulation. Okay, so I want this theory or some little modifications of it, which we will discuss later. And what I want to compute, the vacuum expectation value of the scalar field. Okay, I would like to do that in Euclidean formulation of gravity. This is already challenging because Euclidean formulation of gravity is not very well defined. But okay, I will completely ignore this problem. I cannot say anything sensible about this point except the fact that here in perimeter, there is an activity where people try to search for saddle point being exactly in Minkowskian gravity. And this type of demonstration, perhaps by some analytic continuation, can be reverted into Minkowskian path integral. But I don't want to elaborate on that because I cannot say anything.
Lorentzian
path integral. Yes.
Is that important for the rest of your argument? Is it going to really matter that it's Euclidean?
Well, it will be important because I will be searching an action in Euclidean formulation. Yes, exactly. So that's the problem. Yeah, exactly. That's the problem. So the hope is that you find the solution here. This would correspond to some saddle point. Then we make an analytic continuation into Minkowski space. We will get a complex solution. And if you have Minkowski as path integral, we should study or find out there not only the real saddle point, but the complex saddle point. And the hope is that this complex saddle point will do the same as we have in Euclidean gravity. Okay, but this is hope, which is not substantiated by any computation.
So I don't know if this is something you're going to say later on, and if it is, you know, tell me later on. But if I just in Minkowski space before the path integrals, just in this Pallottini thing. Ask what are the propagating modes? The fact that your connection is now not this the Levi-Civita one is are there new metric modes that are propagating?
No, it's the same. You have massless graviton plus a scalar.
Okay, so there's a
there is no, the number of degrees of freedom is not changed at all. It's exactly the same.
Not equivalent, but not new degrees of freedom.
Yep.
Are you able to say now what is the type of symmetry breaking?
Yeah, I'm coming. Okay, so we want to compute this path integral. We know that if you take configurations which in which phi field is much less than in Planck, then gravity is irrelevant. We will just find out a Kalman-Weinberg potential, which doesn't give us anything. And therefore, what we want to estimate is to account for contributions for phi field, which is very, very large. So if the phi field is very, very large, then the theory which I'm discussing is scale invariant. Okay, it's not conformal invariant, but it's scale. It's not Weyl invariant, but it's scale invariant, global scale invariant. But what is interesting about this theory is that the Planck scale is dynamical. So the larger phi you take, the weaker is gravitational interaction because it scales like phi square. Okay. It's a challenge to compute this contribution, but we made the following conjecture, that if we take a contribution of large Higgs fields, of scalar fields, phi much greater than n Planck over xi, then let's do that in the Einstein frame. Okay? Of course, what kind of frame you take is just a matter of convenience, and if you are able to do exact computation, it shouldn't matter in which frame you work. Now, if you are doing some approximation, it may matter. Okay. So what happens in when you go to Einstein frame? You can introduce a new field, chi, which is related to initial scalar field by this formula. And then you find out that the action in the Einstein frame with canonical normalization of the high field looks like this. Okay, so there is a normal kinetic term, and then there is some potential term. So for the moment, I'm going to forget about this potential term. It will be important for me when I start to discuss inflation. But what is most important here is that once you make this change of variable, you see that if the high field is large, then we have here an exponential dependence. So phi contains an exponential of the high field. And therefore, when you compute this path integral, we will get, in terms of our canonically normalized field, we will get an extra contribution to the action, which comes from the non-trivial relationship between phi and high field. Okay.
Are you still doing the integral over? So you had the Palatini formulation.
Yes.
And you went to the Einstein frame. In that action you wrote in the bottom of the previous slide, are you still integrating over the connection independently?
Yes, that's a good question. Sorry, I didn't tell you about that. So this is already a metric formulation.
So you integrated over the.
Yeah.
And is it true that the connection that you got when you integrated the connection kinetic term has a torsion piece in it that depends on the scale?
No, here no torsion appears at all. So here the torsion will be identically equal to zero. That will be a consequence of equations of motion. So this is not necessarily the case if you include fermions, but I'm not going to touch here. For bosonic theories, torsion is zero.
I'm a bit confused by that. So in the original frame, Palatinian metric formulations are different from each other. But when you go to the Einstein frame,
they're all, oh, yeah, okay. Okay, so if you. I'll tell you what. Yeah, that's a good question. So the question was, suppose that instead of Palatini formulation, I will do exactly the same, but in metric formulation. What is going to change? There are two things which are going to change. So this guy, you will get a different potential. And secondly, the relationship between phi and high will be different. And that will result in a modification of this source term, which appears there. So if you do that in Einstein formulation, then there is no xi square root of xi appearing here. And this happens to be very important. But this can be worked out. And actually, we started with that a couple of years ago when we were trying to use this mechanism. OK, so what this all changes for us? It changes the following, that now, if you want to find out saddle point approximation to find to estimate this integral, we have to include this part in the saddle point definition, because it's exponentially dependent on phi high.
Is there an integral over x?
No, there is no integral. It's a local piece. It's a local piece. And it will be important that this is a local piece in the next couple of slides.
Why don't I roll it into all the ultraviolet divergences? I mean, it sounds like you're following an ultra-local piece in the measure,
yes,
which is going to be in there with all the other ultraviolet divergences.
Yes.
And distances.
Yes.
So why focus on that one as opposed to all the other ones?
Say it again.
So it's phi of x. X against is where you're interested in computing the
so phi of x, yeah.
Well,
so
I'm sure that came from the expectation value. I'm sorry. I thought it was the measure. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
So if I wanted to have a cartoon of this in my head, could I imagine that the phi field is kind of self-regulating? Because like this sort of looks like you're looking for the, you really are looking for the sort of gravitational contributions to the phi mass.
Exactly.
Right? That's what you're doing. But the phi mass is now self-regulating. It's turning off gravity as soon as it becomes too aggressive.
Yes, I think so.
Okay.
I think so.
Is this conformal transformation unique?
Yes. Yeah.
It's the only one.
Yeah. Only one. Yes. So the fact that the part should be incorporated in definition of the saddle point, there is nothing special in that. So the simplest example is try to compute this one-dimensional integral for large n. Okay, if you just find out a saddle point from this exponential for large n, your approximation will break down. So what you have to do to compute this integral, you have to exponentiate this part and account for n dependence in the saddle point. Okay, so this is triviality in this one-dimensional integral. But the same type of considerations were used in at least two other questions in high-energy physics. So one of them was computation of multiparticle production. And another one is a proof of confinement in three-dimensional George glacial model, where you have to compute an expectation of Polyakov loop. And this exponential determines the saddle point. OK, so there is nothing special in that. And now we go ahead and do the job. So everything else is really a straightforward computation. You write down equations of motion. Now, these equations of motion contain the source term. You solve this equations of motion. You find the action and the conjecture. Or if you find out that the action which corresponds to this solution is much greater than 1, then yes, you found the reason why the Higgs vacuum expectation value is much smaller than the Planck scale. So take this model. You find out these equations of motion. You can solve them for small r close to the center of this solution. You get this formula. This is Hawking-Turk instanton, which they use trying to explain the creation of the universe of nothing. So here it has a completely different sense. In their case, this coefficient in front of logarithm was arbitrary. Now it is fixed by this source term. Okay. So the trouble with this solution is the following, that when r goes to 0, we are in the center of this solution. The field diverges, and therefore the total action which we have there, which contains the piece corresponding from the source and from here, is infinite. Okay, so the instanton is suppressed too much. But it's clear that this is not a physical statement, because it would be too naive to expect that this is a complete action. Okay, there should be higher order terms, like you mentioned, phi to the six and others, which should be added to this action. And so these terms should regulate this singularity. So what kind of terms we would like to add? So I would like to add the terms which do not introduce new degree of freedom, because if new degrees of freedom are introduced, and if they're heavy, then the whole idea will be spoiled out. We get heavy particles which can contribute to the Higgs mass. I don't want to spoil asymptotic scale invariance when the scalar field goes to infinity. Actually, this is automatic if I only add to the theory the counter terms which are following from the structure of the model. And yet another criterion, which is not very constraining, is that if you add extra terms, you have to make sure that your low energy symmetry, your low energy theory remains reasonable. It doesn't break unitarity, it doesn't have superluminal propagation, et cetera, et cetera. So here is the term which we can add. We tried with others, doesn't matter, essentially. And now.
Normally, you wouldn't have to guess these terms. Normally, you just take your Lagrangian, you do your loops, and you get whatever you get, right? And
you can get.
But the reason you're not doing that is because you want your loop space, and that fluctuation is actually very out of control, right? So is that why you're reducing guessing these things? Because since you're a Lagrangian net, you should be able to just calculate all these things and see what you get. And normally, you get everything.
You don't get everything. That depends on your approach to effective field theory. So the approach which I'm having here is the following. So I have this action, okay? And then I start, so for me, this is a parent action. I take this parent action and I compute with this action all possible diagrams, okay? Many of them will be divergent, and I will have to add to this action the counter terms which remove these divergences. But there will be a specific structure of counter term which I need. And I add only those which remove divergences. So in this way, my theory is self-contained, okay? And
in the sense that all the terms you get, you don't have to choose.
And all these terms will be coming, of course, with arbitrary coefficients, because I don't know how to fix them, okay?
And normally, the terms that you get when you do that don't satisfy your assumptions like not introducing new degrees of freedom.
If I treat them as a perturbation, of course, they will not introduce degree. But if I add them to the action, they will. Okay, so yeah.
That would be what you do if you're doing around the vacuum. But now you've gone to this Euclidean saddle point and you really have to be Euclidean to balance it against the real field, right? And now you've got the problem that you've got this metric mode, which is sick. So you can't do that calculation anymore because your path integral is not under control. So is that.
I can tell you what we've done, okay? So we added a different type of operator of this sort there, and we saw what do they do, okay? And what we do see that many of these operators stabilize the solution in the following sense, that instead of diverging at phi equal to zero, start to be convergent, and so that you get the finite action. Okay, so there are terms which stabilize the solution. There are terms which destabilize the solution. So, for instance, if here I would choose minus sign, then it would be bad. Okay, plus sign is good because then the solution is stable. Phi at equal to zero at point equal to zero is equal to some finite numbers, and this is not the case for the minus sign. So the point which I making here is that there exists a set of operators of this type, which is pretty large, which stabilize this solution. Okay, and it's not necessarily that all possible operators stabilize this solution. Okay, if it happens that you add some operators and you found that your action, say, is very, very small, then I would interpret that as no new scale is generated, that non-perturbative gravity effects are such that they are driving the Higgs mass to the Planck value. So my point is that there is a set of this higher dimensional operator which do the job. And
what you don't know, though, is that if you start off where you said you started off and just do the loops and see what you get, that you only get those operators, right? That's the thing. It may be true, but
But okay, so you get infinite number of different terms, and the statement is that there are a combination of signs and coefficient in front of them, which remove this solution completely, or make the action of the solution being small. But there is another set of which this is a regular solution with the action which we need. Okay, and so from here, I would conclude that this is the correct UV completion of this theory.
Just one point is that the Euclidean action, when you couple it to gravity, if you do the, like you were saying, do the path integral over real metrics, then that's unbounded below. But if you break the, I would say that's not the right contour, and that you, if you break the metric into the determinant one piece and the conformal factor, now you integrate the right contour. A well defined contour is where you integrate the determinant one part of the metric over real values and the conformal factor over imaginary values. I think that then does give a.
That's like a rule rather than a calculation, right? That's,
well, it's the. I mean, so in a way, so is going to Euclidean space. But the reason that one started going to Euclidean space originally was that that was some appropriate analytic continuation away from the original Lorentzian thing you want to calculate. And then the question is just as long as you're analytically continuing, what's the right contour to take around that saddle point to get a convergent answer if you can analytically continue back?
Right.
So I don't claim, I don't claim to show that this is the right saddle point that analytically continues back to the right Lorentzian answer. I'm just saying it could be. I mean, it's clear that the one where you take the Euclidean saddle point and then integrate over real values of the metric is not the right answer. It's like you say, that gives infinity. It could be that this other one is. Something like Prud-Lipschitz theory would be a more systematic way to find the right saddle point and contour. And I personally haven't done mm-hmm.
But in, like in all non-gravitational theories, because the spirit of that is, you know, back in the day, was that you know, if you did scalar field theories or something, then if you just did a WPB calculation in Lorentzian signature, it was giving you what you got in a Euclidean calculation, and all the toggling kind of went through. But then the evidence for that in gravity just really doesn't exist, right? So it's kind of a hope that it'll give you something. You and then the long answer.
This is certainly true. Okay, as I stressed. Of course, when we are in Euclidean gravity, we're on extremely shaky grounds. Okay, so the best way to do that is to take Minkowskian formulation of path integral, search for complex saddle points, find out whether these saddle points are essential or not, and if they are, include them in path integral. So this type of thing. It's very easy to say in words, but very, very difficult to do. So there are examples of these computations which are done for mini superspace models, where you can really use the Minkowskian path integral. You can then see which kind of Euclidean saddle points are relevant, which are irrelevant. But once you think about field theory, I mean, I don't know how to do that. Okay, it's a dream to move in this direction, but it's a not realized dream at the moment. But the interesting point here is this plot. So what we have on this plot is this axis is a logarithm of xi, this non-minimal coupling. This axis here is the amplitude of this higher dimensional operator, which we introduced. Okay, there is 6th power, but I can represent the same if you take here 4th power. They all look similar. And then this black line, it shows the combination of these two parameters, which leads to correct hierarchy between the Planck scale and the Fermi scale. So you have to be this line, okay? So it's interesting to see that if I take natural quote at quote parameter delta of the order of 1, so we are here, then if xi is sufficiently large, then I achieve the goal. And this action, Euclidean action, happens to be proportional to square root of xi with some coefficient. So the larger xi is, the larger the action, and then the more suppression you have. Okay, so.
Negative signs in the kinetic terms, which is ghosts.
Yes. No. Here, that was exactly the point. That if you so this type of operator, it's written in Euclidean space. You can continue it to Minkowski space, and then the signs there are such that it doesn't introduce any Gauss, it doesn't introduce any new degree of freedom. And moreover, this type of term, you're not going to get any superliminal propagation. So this is perfectly fine term from effective.
The energy is positive.
Yeah, the energy is positive, everything is fine. Okay. And well, I think I should skip that. So let me go very, very quickly through inflation. So it's amazing that the very same theory with the large xi leads to inflation. Okay, and
xi have to be in the previous thing? You had that parabola. It was
yes.
In order 1-ish or 8-ish?
Yeah, this
wasn't long, I
see. Yeah, so this log xi, so if you are here, then xi is very large, about 1 million.
Where is xi in the Lagrangian again? Sorry.
Sorry?
Where is xi in the Lagrangian again? I missed that.
It was non-minimal coupling of the scalar field to gravity. Okay, so if you take this Palatini formulation, then this happens to be a very, very good theory for Higgs inflation, even better than original Higgs inflation. And I will tell you why in a second. I go through that very, very quickly because I run out of time. You have this potential, and then you can do inflationary computations very easily. They are pretty much standard. You find that in metric Higgs inflation, everything works when this non-minimal coupling psi is some large number times square root of lambda, where lambda is scalar self-coupling. In Palatini Higgs inflation, xi should be even larger number times to the first power of lambda. So these two relationships are coming from Kobe normalization on the amplitude of scalar fluctuations. Okay, so the predictions are for scalar indices the same, 0.97, the same formula. For the gravitational waves to scalar ratio, the Palatini Higgs inflation happen to depend on xi, and it gives r, which is much, much larger than this number. Okay, even this number is extremely hard to observe, and so here it's even smaller. But if you can go up to this value, then you can compare Palatini and Higgs inflation. So after inflation, the Higgs energy goes into other degrees of freedom, and this happens almost instantaneously because of different mechanisms. But what is interesting is that for if you look at different cutoffs in this theory, which appear at energies smaller than the Planck scale, then you find out that for the metric theory, the cutoff is M Planck divided by xi, which is actually smaller than inflationary scale, and that leads to some doubts and that leads to refinement of the formalism. But for Falatini case, this cutoff is changed drastically and it's of the same order of magnitude as the scale of inflation. So everything, so from this point of view, Palatini case is.
So because you said that if I compare the Palatini, the difference between, you know, the what would have happened in Higgs inflation and then this, the potential change basically.
Yes, yes.
So what is it about the potential that makes that power cutting change?
This change happens because you have different mixing between longitudinal part of the metric and the Higgs field. So it is this point which is different. So because of non-minimal coupling of Higgs to gravity, there is a mixing between determinant of the metric and the scalar field. And in Palatini and the Higgs, this is different. And this changes a lot. Okay.
To make inflation work, you need a slowly rolling potential. Do you get that?
Yeah, yeah. You get a slowly rolling potential because of non-minimal coupling in both cases. But this throw roll is somewhat different in metric and Palatini case.
The problem with inflation is that there isn't a number of potentials.
Yes.
You have a unique potential.
Yeah, here, well, there is unique potential attributed to this theory.
This thing.
Yeah, to this. And this potential is different for metric and Palatini case.
Could we see one more time the slide with the black curve? So in the inflation model, we would be up at 10?
Yeah, so inflation prefers this value. Okay, so why this value?
Didn't you say that psi should be 10 to the 10?
No. It's the same picture. It's identical picture. Okay. So this curve comes from Fermi and Planck relation. For inflation, the value of delta doesn't matter because this is derivative coupling. This doesn't participate in inflation at all. So what the only thing which happens is this parameter psi. And so if you are here, then first of all, the inflation is successful. It can go through. And this upper limit is coming from the lower limit on the top quark mass, which coming from LHC. So here, the top mass would be too small, but here it all look to be the case.
Oh, can you go back one? We do have a parameter called psi.
Yes.
I don't think it's a parameter. A Hubble slow roll parameter called psi. That's not the one you.
No. It's not. No, psi is just parameter of the action.
Of your theory.
Yeah.
Okay. Because I thought you said this psi parameter matters.
Yes, this psi parameter matters. Okay. If you forget about radiative corrections, which scale self-coupling has in the standard model, then you can always have a good inflation almost for any value of psi. You just change the scale of self-coupling, you adapt the parameter psi accordingly, and you will get a perfect inflation. So what I'm plugging in this plot, I'm plugging in extra information which comes from particle physics, which tells me what the scalar self-coupling should be at this very, very high energies. Okay, and this selects this domain.
Right, so your free variable here is tuning psi, right? Or so by tuning that, you get the amplitude of a scalar perturbation?
No, scalar perturbation, they don't depend on psi. Only tensor perturbation depend on psi.
So what amplitude do you get?
Yeah, for the so this is what you get for a scalar perturbation, you're getting 0.97, and for R you are getting this number, which is pretty small because disk size, very large number, and the number of foldings is 60. So that's a very, very small number, which you will never, ever be able to detect.
The equation above is relating psi to lambda is the condition to get the correct one perturbation. So the one for the Palatine, it says psi is 10 to the 10 lambda.
So it
that's
is.
The 10 to the 10 from the size of the perturbation.
So it does fix the value of psi, right? Or
it
fixes
psi. A combination of psi and lambda is fixed by that condition.
Okay.
So the very first kind of most root thing is this relationship, which tells you what fixes the energy density at inflation. Okay, and it gives you it comes from this Cobbe normalization 10 to the minus 5. Four. So this is this one here. Okay, so once this is fixed, you decrease the arbitrariness in your inflationary potential, and that leads to the scalar tilt, which is independent on psi and lambda, which depends on the number of foldings, and for tensor perturbations you get this one. Okay, so this I think is everything which I wanted to tell you is. That perhaps this ratio, the small value of this ratio, is telling us that there are no new particles with masses between the Fermi and Planck scales. Otherwise, we will get hierarchy problem. And perhaps it's telling us that the smallness of the Fermi scale is a semi-classical non-perturbative effect. It happened amazing to us, at least, because we were struggling with metric perturbation, trying with metric formulation, trying to get this effect, and we were getting some extremely complicated ad hoc expressions. And now you start from Palatini, and everything works perfectly. And well, of course, there are quite a number of open problems which were already discussed here. We cannot make this prediction in reality because it depends on details of high energy physics, though we see that the reasonable choice of these parameters can lead to a small value. Of course, there is an issue associated with Euclidean gravity, how to do non-perturbative physics in quantum gravity, how to find the saddle points. And we cannot estimate here any other effects other than perturbative and semi-classical. So maybe there is something else which is completely not caught by this type of consideration. Thank you very much.
Okay, before maybe one last question, I just want to remind everyone that we'll be having dinner with Misha at 6. You're all invited to join and be sure if you want. Anyway, is there maybe one? We had a lot of questions, of course. Maybe one last question? No, everyone's questioned out. Okay, well, let's thank Misha again. Okay.